The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Paul Tremblay. He joins us on the telephone in Massachusetts. He's got a new novel out. It's called Survivor Song. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, I'm happy to be back. Where else am I going to be? sorry, bad joke about everyone being stuck in their homes.
Well, you're a high school teacher, right? How's that looking for fall classes?
I guess to be determined. I mean, when we left school, the buzzword was hybrid. So some kids would be in class, some kids would be at home, and the kids at home would have to somehow be able to watch what we're doing in class. I teach at a small private school, so that's, I guess, somewhat more feasible. But, honestly, still waiting for more direction as opposed to, the teachers just have to figure out for themselves, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing when you have a book that comes out that just seems like such a product of coincidence, but you've certainly got one here, don't you?
Yeah, no. certainly some of the coincidences or the things that match up with what we're going through is odd. And it's been sort of weird just personally, especially in the early months of quarantine, sort of wrapping my head around, the book and what we were going through.
Hmm. The book Survivor Song is about the outbreak of should we call it a virus?
Yeah.
Okay. Set the ground level here for us. What's the gist?
So, the novel opens with sort of like in the middle of the early going of a outbreak of a super rabies-like virus in the Massachusetts area. And the novel opens with a woman named Natalie who's 8 months pregnant. And she and her husband are attacked by a man who's been infected by the super rabies virus. And she ends up getting bit. And so she, really the rest of the novel is her sort of journey through, the emergency and collapse state of Massachusetts to try to get help. And she enlists her best friend, who is Dr. Romola Sherman. She's a pediatrician. And most of the novel really only takes place over 4 to 6 hours, so it's almost told in full time. I didn't want to – we've all read, the virus or – I wouldn't necessarily call this a zombie novel, but maybe zombie adjacent. I think we've all read the books where, it's like cast of thousands and it's, sort of this big, wide story. And I really wanted to make it like a smaller, quieter story about these two characters in the middle of the wider maelstrom.
And even though it's not a zombie book, they use the word zombie quite a bit, including particularly two characters who you bring into the story. And I understand that these two young men were in a previous book. I have not read the other book. Who are these guys?
Yeah, so Josh and Luis were major characters in my novel, Disappearance at Devil's Rock, which came out after A Head Full of Ghosts and sort of in between Cabin at the End of the World, because I believe we talked about those books.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so a part of their role, because they're not in the book for super super long, but I figured that even though let me back up a little bit. What I tried to do was take this sort of quasi zombie idea that I had and try to really root it in reality as much as I could.
Mm.
So that's where the rabies virus comes into play. I took essentially real rabies and only changed the timeline of infection and made the people who suffer from it a little bit more violent. But otherwise, it's real rabies. So they're not zombies. They're infected people, who, because of the virus, what it does to their brain, makes them act violently. But I knew, especially from the reader's side of thing, that, if this were to really happen today, people would call them zombies or talk, or use the zombie word. So, those two characters sort of show up as like self-appointed zombie experts. And, the doctor is telling them all the time, no, these aren't zombies, they're people.
Mm.
I also liked having the return of those two characters. I thought it was a good juxtaposition of their friendship compared to the main friendship of the novel, Natalie and Romola.
They bring a lot of fun to the story, those two young men, just the way they talk. It's fun. It's a little bit of comic relief, even though they're doing something really serious.
No, that was definitely one of the things I wanted to. And Yeah. So the slang they used was sort of the slang that was going around my school at the time of writing the book.
Oh. The book is Survivor Song. Paul Tremblay joins us. This hydrophobia, did you make that up?
No, that's a real rabies symptom, yeah.
Huh.
One of the stranger ones.
I never heard of that. Tell us what it is.
Yeah, so so people who succumb to rabies, so maybe just to explain rabies a little bit, it's such a unique virus. It doesn't travel through the blood. You know, if you were to be bit by a rabid animal, for example, the virus attaches to your nerve and slowly crawls up your nervous system. You know, so there's no blood test for rabies until the virus passes through the brain barrier. And once it passes through the brain barrier, it's not curable. It's eminently curable now if you get bit. Like, you can get, you know, a rabies shot, but as long as it doesn't pass through the brain.
Mm.
So if you are fully infected with rabies at the point where it's, you know, that the virus has gotten into your brain and started, you know, messing with the wires, people who suffer from rabies have this weird symptom called hydrophobia where their body physically reacts just to even being close to water. Like, they start vibrating or shaking, or they can't drink water. They'll even, like, try to, you know, involuntarily, like, push it away. I mean, if you want to go on a deep dive, it's kind of hard to watch, but, you know, there are clips of people who suffer from rabies on YouTube, and you can kind of see, you know, some of those disturbing things that end up happening to someone who's infected with rabies.
Is that how you got the notion that in your story you could use water kind of like garlic on a vampire? Or?
Yeah, well, as a, you know, a horror fan and horror writer, the interesting part about rabies and how it's, you know, it's been a scourge of humanity for centuries, since well beyond the Dark Ages. You know, it seems pretty clear to me, especially that, it seems clear to me that so many of our monsters, like, they started from rabies. I mean, a lot of the myths of the werewolf, zombies as well, obviously, and, you know, the vampires, a lot of vampire lore has them being afraid of water, never mind just regular holy water. So, you know, when I was reading about rabies, it was really interesting to see how our human experience with people who have been infected with rabies, you know, really sort of mirrors so many of our monsters.
A lot of this story involves what I would describe as a road trip. They're trying to get somewhere, our two central characters. And it's quite an experience because they keep encountering all kinds of scary stuff along the way. And this is just really fun to read as a reader of horror. It's just so thrilling and enjoyable because you just never know what's coming around the corner.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's funny, a lot of the reaction I've been getting, you know, has been positive, but, like, a lot of people have been like, wow, this is really close to what we're going through. You know, and part of that, I think, is just, you know, being in the moment, obviously, that we're, you know, you're reading about a virus tale. It's hard not to just take your own experience and put it into the book, which is something every writer wants. I mean, I whatever I'm writing, I would like to think that I've left enough space for the reader to bring their own experience. So it just happens in this sort of heightened experience that we're having, is one way of putting it, you know, with the coronavirus. You know, definitely, I won't say informs the novel necessarily, but it certainly puts a different read on it, like, you know, compared to my editor, there really haven't been very many people who have read this book before coronavirus hit, because I turned in my final edits to this novel in October of 2019. I wonder how the book would read, you know, if we weren't living through the coronavirus.
The book is Survivor Song by Paul Tremblay, and it truly is haunting because as you read it, and I'm sure many reviewers, if they haven't cited this portion already, they will. You write, the virus doesn't herald the end of the world or of the United States or even of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. In the coming days, conditions will continue to deteriorate. Emergency services and other public safety nets will be stretched to their breaking points. Fear, panic, misinformation, a myopic, sluggish federal bureaucracy further hamstrung by a president, unwilling and woefully unequipped to make the rational, science-based decisions necessary. Ooh. You went back and wrote that later, right? Just kidding.
Yeah, no, I know. No. Yeah. I feel like the latter part wasn't difficult to predict, honestly. And my sister is a nurse at a big city hospital in Boston.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm very, you know, she's one of my best friends. We're very close. So a lot of the a lot of the medical response that is referenced within the novel is through her help. Like, I went to her for research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's really honestly been warning me for years about how our, you know, healthcare system is broken. And, you know, so that was sort of the things that I was sort of reflecting on when I was writing the book, that, you know, there is, you know, there is no national coordinated health response. You know, so what would happen if we had an epidemic or a pandemic like this? And more specifically, my sister unfortunately got a preview, I think, of what we're all living through in 2014 during, you know, the Ebola outbreak. Obviously, it was much bigger in Africa, but in the U.S. we had a few patients and a few nurses get infected.
Mm-hmm.
And her hospital was going to be one of the hospitals that would, you know, take Ebola patients if there was a surge of them suddenly in this area. No, and I vividly remember talking to her about it, and her hospital's like initial emergency Ebola plans that they sent to her were lacking, shall we say. You know, it was the first time I had ever really heard of PPE, and you know, luckily there were no Ebola patients, and there weren't that many in the U.S. There certainly wasn't any in Boston, and you know, they sent eventual plans that were a little bit more, I think, you know, level-headed, but you know, that sort of stuck with me. And those are the things we sort of talked about when I was in the research part of the novel. So a lot of that anxiety and even some of the things that my sister was talking to about coworkers ended up in the book. So, I mean, that part of it, any reference to PPE or, you know, hospitals running out of materials and stuff like that was all, you know, just based on that brief experience that my sister had.
Well, it seems prescient now. You were really on top of the story. And the medical system in your story is really in chaos. And that is the thing that's driving the storyline, because this poor woman, she's about ready to have a baby. She's maybe infected with the virus. Her friend is trying to help her to do anything that she can. And then you have these poignant, short little chapters where the expectant mother is dictating a message on her phone to her unborn child. And you talk about pulling the heartstrings, Paul. Man,
yeah.
That was tough.
Thanks. So, like, at the very early part of going into the novel, I knew I wanted to stick mainly to the doctor's point of view, Romola, and partly because I didn't want to be, like, the point of view of Natalie, because I didn't feel like I should be writing about what it feels like to be a 8-month pregnant woman. I just didn't think that would come off as very real. But what I felt like I could do was, you know, slip her point of view in, or slip her character in a little bit more with those, you know, with the recorded messages that she leaves to her child.
Mm.
You know, with the hope that those messages would sort of resonate with anybody who's a parent and, you know, who was worried about what the future for their kid might look like. So those are some of the things I was thinking about when I was, you know, when I put those in.
And Romola is a character who is kind of an outsider. She's not from America. She's a person of color. And we don't really expect this to be part of the story, but it does become part of the story in a way. I don't want to give away too much about what goes on, but we have some reactionary elements out there.
Sure.
Running around. And once again, this just seems so prescient, even though this is an ongoing problem.
Right. Well, I mean, you're referencing, I think I could say, you know, I thought, like, were we to have, like, a virus like I described in my book, that there would be sort of, an extreme right-wing element that would instantly come up with conspiracy theories, you know, which obviously has happened. I feel like, if anything, I underestimated, like, how many, you know, the types of conspiracy theories that would show up, or even how mainstream it would sort of become. So I don't know, like, I've been fascinated as a writer for almost like 3 or 4 novels now, in some way within a book, messing around with how the idea of misinformation and how that impacts, you know, how it impacts our daily lives.
Uh-huh.
I make reference to it in The Cabin at the End of the World, same with the other novels that I previously mentioned, The Head Full of Ghosts and Disappearance at Devil's Rock. So, you know, when I was writing a book about, you know, a virus, you know, which is one of my greatest fears, and even writing it in 2018 and 2019, my fear on top of that would be, well, geez, you know, given the existence of the anti-vaxxers and stuff like that, it's like, well, even if, you know, we get a handle on it, I think it's going to be made more difficult by just, people not believing it by misinformation being out there.
Mm.
So, you know, that was all part of it. And as far as like who Romola ended up to be, part of her character was a little bit of a homage to where I got the idea from the novel from. I happened to be in England for the first time in my life when I sort of came up with the original What If that became this novel. But also, you know, I figured who Romola is, you know, she's, you know, Anglo-Indian, but I don't know, in the Boston area, if you go to, we have such, you know, we're lucky to have like a lot of great hospitals, and so many of these doctors are from other countries. You know, so I wanted to make sure I represented that.
Uh-huh. Another pleasurable aspect to me as a reader, and I'm sure a lot of other readers will agree, is your ability to just suddenly ratchet up the action with some startling, really sudden thing happening, like at the beginning of the story. You suddenly have this action just come out of nowhere. And I think one of my favorite sections, because of this ability of yours to do this quick action, it is when they encounter this group of guys with the pickup truck and just everything that goes out there. Yeah. It was almost like a violent farce.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You know, some of the things in the book I'm trying to, you know, maybe if not reference it, but at least like be in conversation with, you know, some of the tropes that we know about, you know, zombie or virus stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're so pervasive in our culture. You know, especially the zombie stuff. I mean, right? One of the like most popular television shows ever is The Walking Dead. And, you know, I think for so many sort of zombie narratives or zombie adjacent narratives, you know, I already mentioned one of the things I wanted to tweak. Instead of doing like a story where it's like a cast of thousands, I really wanted to zoom in on a couple characters. The other part of it was, you know, when you already read the section that comes from, you know, I tell the reader that this is not the end of the world. This is not the end of Massachusetts. You know, I did not want to write a novel that was an end-of-the-world novel. I didn't want to, you know, so many zombie stories or so many virus stories sort of almost take, like, this loving, fetishistic, like, description of how the world sort of breaks down and falls apart to nothingness, and people instantly devolve into, if not cannibals, they instantly devolve into, you know, barbaric sort of hordes or something like that. So, you know, you mentioned there is this group. I mean, I think they're a little bit more complex. I mean, a couple of them, I think, are clearly more than ignorant, but there are a few, I think, who are just scared, you know.
Uh-huh.
And,
yeah.
You know, so even for all those characters, I mean, and for all of us, I mean, fear is the mind killer. You know, fear makes us make very poor decisions, and so much of our lives are either governed by fear or, you know, people are trying to sell us things through fear. It's really you know, that's part of the whole, like, idea of how misinformation gets spread, because people take advantage of fear. And I don't know, fear taps instantly into our lizard brains, and it's really hard to overcome the lizard brain with rational thought. It takes a lot of work.
Well, I was rooting for Rin Tin Tin, and I appreciate the cameo.
Thank you.
That was very well done. And are you saying that you're being unambiguous in this one, Paul? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, I know, huh? big surprise. I mean, I knew I couldn't do that. I can't do that for every single novel. Uh-huh. But also, like, there was no place for ambiguity in this. You know, ambiguity fit the themes of the other book. It was sort of like the point of the other novels that I had written, that the uncertainty underneath everything made it hopefully more frightening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or this, you know, this, you know, there was no supernatural element. You know, I don't want to like jam something in there that doesn't work. So, you know, that said, it was a little, you know, I think that was part of the reason why maybe this book was a little bit difficult to write at the beginning, just because I was a little bit out of my comfort zone. But that's also a good thing. You know, I hope to push myself with each book.
Uh-huh. Well, the last time we had you on the show was a year ago for your collection, Growing Things and Other Stories.
Right.
And knowing the cycle that most publishers are on, if a writer can keep up with that brutal pace with deadlines, the paperback of the previous book will usually come out right before the next hardcover, and it looks like that's the case with this one. I see it just came out in paperback.
Yeah, on the same day.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really wonderful collection.
Thank you.
And I was just thinking about it the other day because, as I mentioned before, just the way that you laid them out and the way that you were having fun with them. And one of the ones that I thoroughly enjoyed was the one, the notes from the dog walkers. And I was just thinking about that. That story just keeps coming back to me. I don't know why.
Thanks. That was a fun, as much as anything, writing-wise is fun. I mean, for me, the fun part is after when I'm done. That's the part I'm addicted to. But it was, you know, definitely a fun story to write and riff on. No, and I'm very glad. I'm glad it stuck with you. I appreciate that.
Now, when you say when you're finished, that's the part that sticks with you or that you enjoy, what do you mean? Just the feeling of satisfaction, like you got the darn thing completed to your...
Yeah, like, I mean, and then I'm excited, like, I want to show people, have them read it. To me, that's the fun part.
Okay.
You know, and when I'm in the middle of a story, I mean, it's just so filled with doubt and, you know, almost like self-flagellation and beating yourself up and questioning every step. You know, there are parts that can be fun, like the moments of discovery are really cool. But I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I think I picked up a pen in the first place or start, I don't really write much with a pen, I should say. The reason why I still clack at the keyboard is, I don't know, part of it was just proving to, like, I don't know, the shy, overly sensitive child/teen that I was, proving that, you know, I had something to say and other people, and a few other people might want to listen to it. So I think that's part why I'm like, I'm so excited when I have something that's completely done because now I finally get to share it with some other people.
The novelist Ian Rankin is a favorite writer of mine, a guy I really like to interview. And one aspect of him that I really appreciate is the fact that he's a frustrated musician. and I kind of get the feeling maybe you're a little bit like that too.
Oh, definitely. If I had a time machine and I had a choice, like I wanted to be a guitar player first. Like that was my first inkling to having like a creative outlet. You know, I wanted to be like a punk metal guitar player. But I eventually found out I was a better writer than guitar player. So I still play for fun, but certainly not a musician.
And you like those short, fast songs?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think I have somewhat of an eclectic taste, but yeah, my favorites tend to be the short, fast, angry ones.
What are some of the bands that were your favorites back in the day?
Oh, so my absolute favorite is a 1980s punk band called Husker Du, from Minneapolis, and they had two main songwriters, Grant Hart and Bob Mould. And Bob Mould has gone on to make a lot of music, so he remains like a favorite musician. Geez, other favorite bands, I don't know. There's so many. And music is something I try to keep up with. And I don't know, I'm a huge fan. To the point where I half joke that I've successfully stalked many of my favorite bands with my writing. Meaning, like, I'll send, like, a book to, like, if I get the contact information for certain singers or bands, I'll reach out and be like, hey, big fan, just want to send you a book as a thanks, or... I often in my novels quote in the epigraph from song lyrics from bands that I like.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I don't know, my favorite bands like Clutch and Helmet and Future of the Left, which is a British band, you know, I've become friendly with because, you know, a lot of these guys are readers and, you know, they appreciate, you know, they happen to like the books and I like their stuff. So that's been a lot of fun.
So you stay current. You're still listening. You haven't shut down.
No, I have not shut down. Definitely not. It gets harder. I mean, our days get so busy, but I don't know. Music's been such a big part of my life. And that thrill of discovery, you know, when I do find a new band, even though, like, you can feel like, you know, I'm never going to find someone, like, it's not going to replicate that feeling I had when I was a kid. You know, it's different now, but that doesn't mean it's a bad different. But, for the example of Survivor Song, I quote from a band named Big Business, and they're a recent discovery. A friend of mine recommended them to me, and I was blown away. And you know, I was very happy to be able to get permission from them to quote from a song for Survivor Song.
What's your ideal writing environment?
Well, it's been at home for the last 6 months. Especially in the early going of my writing, it was a good lesson that there is no ideal writing environment. That, you know, because I'm still a high school math teacher, and when my kids were really young, my kids are 15 and 19 now, so they're a little bit more autonomous. Especially when they're little, I didn't want to take away from, you know, being a dad or take away from being a husband. So sometimes my writing time was at really odd moments, like if I had brought my son to a baseball clinic and he was going to be there for 2 hours, you know, I would bring my laptop. I would just make sure that I had headphones so I could drown out the noise. So I got to be pretty good at, once it was time to write, I could sort of block out everything else that was happening. I guess I still have that. Most of the time these days I'm writing at home, but you know, I don't have like a private office necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just an open room with some open doors. So again, if it's just like a time where like my son's blasting music or, you know, someone's watching TV, you know, I still go to the headphones just to block out and write.
Do you listen to music then when you're writing?
I used to prefer silence, but I've had to go to music so often just to block out noise. It's almost like I kind of have to listen to it now. But
gotcha.
So yeah, and if but never music with lyrics, because I love listening to lyrics, so those distract me. So it has to be instrumental music that I listen to. So typically, I'm listening to like movie soundtracks.
Okay. And one other thing I'm curious about: what are you reading? What's the book that you read recently just knocked your socks off?
Well, I'd love to mention, you know, I read it a while ago, but it comes out July 14th, which is, as we're recording, is today, is Stephen Graham Jones's The Only Good Indians.
Oh.
It's just an amazing book, and it sort of mashes together, like, literary Native American fiction and horror in just such an inventive and honest way. Stephen is Blackfeet Native American, and, you know, the book is a lot about, you know, his experience, but it's also this genuinely, you know, frightening horror story as well. So I can't recommend that book enough. I've also recently read Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia, which is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
A really inventive, you know, way of transporting like a Victorian, you know, Victorian style house into, you know, the outskirts of Mexico City. Just really smart, very well done, very entertaining. And one more that just came out this month, too, which was a new discovery for me. He's a first-time author. His name is John Fram. It's called The Bright Lands. And if you look at the cover, there's nothing on it that says it's horror. You look at it and you think, oh, it's like a Texas high school football story, which it sort of is, but it becomes like this really crazy horror story that's, you know, with a bunch of characters, but the main one is a young adult who grew up, you know, gay in Texas and obviously did not have a good experience. And, you know, he moved away to New York City, but he had to come back home for certain reasons. So it's actually a nice twist on the sort of on that old horror trope of, you know, someone returning to their hometown to confront a horror.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, John's character has to confront a couple of different horrors, obviously one made of, one made by, you know, humanity and the other one, you know, an actual monster. Yeah, so there's three that I would highly recommend, three recent ones.
Thank you so much for those tips.
Sure.
Paul, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
No, thank you, Vic. No, I appreciate it. Yeah, this is great. We should do this once a year.
Let's do it. My guest has been Paul Tremblay. His book is Survivor, Song for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.